Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Recently, I was looking at Smithsonian Magazine, and I found a very peculiar article. It was entitled Pacific Treasure, From Kitsch to Cool, The Rise and Fall and Rise of a Hawaiian Export is a Shirt Tale Like No Other. We're going to talk about the Aloha Shirt. Mainland Americans have long looked to Hawaii to ease their minds. At the height of World War I, with America about to enter the conflict, Hawaiian music was all the rage. In 1916, Hawaiian records outsold all other genres, while ukuleles were so ubiquitous in college dorms and upper-class nightclubs that the New York Tribune ran a full-page illustration of an imagined ukulele square, the Hawaiian Quarter of New York. During the Great Depression, Americans again cast their eyes toward Hawaii, co-opting another piece of Hawaiian culture, the Aloha Shirt. Though its precise origins are lost in history, the Aloha Shirt first appeared in Hawaii in the 1920s or perhaps 1930s, probably when local Japanese women adapted kimono fabric for use in men's shirting. The shirts achieved some popularity among tourists to Hawaii and found greater commercial success when they hit the mainland in the mid-1930s. America at the time was riddled with hardship and with anxiety, with many men out of work and many others struggling to hold on to their breadwinner status. Perhaps in response, hypermanliness came into vogue. The popularity of bodybuilding skyrocketed. Superman burst onto the scene. It may seem paradoxical that men embraced a garment with such feminine appeal. You'd better get two or three because it's a cinch your daughter, sister, or wife, or even mother will want this bright colored shirt as soon as she sees it, the Los Angeles Times teased in 1936. That didn't stop men from buying. And by 1940, Aloha shirts were bringing in more than $11 million annually. That's in today's money. One reason men adopted a garment otherwise suited to their sister's closet was that rich and famous men wore it. Visitors to Hawaii in the 1930s were invariably wealthy, and before long, Aloha shirts were being worn by celebrities whom everyday Americans sought to emulate. American heroes from three-time Olympic swimming champion and surfing pioneer Duke Kahanamoku to singer Bing Crosby were lending their names to particular brands. Those endorsements, says Dale Hope, a historian and the author of The Aloha Shirt, Spirit of the Islands, had a huge effect on people purchasing those shirts. If you could wear what the man unscathed by the Depression was wearing, it didn't matter that it was feminine. You looked like someone who didn't need to worry about his masculinity, his masculine bona fides. Once the shirt reached stores in the lower 48, though, any day laborer could have for a dollar what before had required an exorbitant trip cost. A man in an Aloha shirt with its depictions of hula dancers and luaus, symbols of picturable and picturesque, one journalist put it in 1939, could look the part of the carefree swell. The notion that Hawaii was a quiet paradise was shattered in 1941 with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And makers of Aloha shirts, like others in the garment industry, turned to supplying the war effort. When productions resumed, Japanese-influenced designs that had been common, featuring cherry blossoms and shrines, temporarily fell out of fashion and were supplanted by the designs that highlighted Hawaii's local culture. Service members returning to the mainland from the Pacific made the signature appeal more popular than ever. By the 1960s, the shirt had become truly ubiquitous. Aloha Fridays were a fixture of a certain kind of workplace, and everyone, from Elvis to the decidedly unhip Richard Nixon, seemed to have an Aloha shirt. Over time, perhaps inevitably, it lapsed into the realm of corny suburban dad wear. Yet in just the past 5 years, fashion magazines have been heralding a comeback, and high-end labels like Gucci are taking the Aloha shirt to new heights with prints that draw on Japanese designs favored in the garment's early days. Meanwhile, some shirt makers from Hawaii's old guard are still going strong. Kahala, founded in 1936 as one of the first brands producing Aloha shirts, has been raiding its vaults to reproduce designs which date back to the 1930s, including some that were popularized by Duke Kahanamoku. People are looking to bring some light, some color, some vibrancy into their lives. Kahala's general manager says, "I think that's needed now more than ever. If an Aloha shirt can help anyone improve somebody's day, I think that's pretty powerful." COVID and the drive-in movie surge. Is this a fleeting diversion we have? Don't tell New York or Pennsylvania, but America's drive-in movie theaters might be enjoying a rebirth. across much of the country. Operators of the throwback outdoor cinemas are either opening early for the season or reporting up to twice as many ticket sales as the coronavirus outbreak has shuttered indoor theaters or other gathering places. After all, seeing a movie at a drive-in can require little to no human contact, largely because patrons are, of course, confined to their cars during the showing. But while many of America's 305 remaining drive-ins have reason to hope for a big summer ahead, much will depend on social isolating restrictions. The boom has thus far been limited to a fraction of those 305 theaters, almost a third of the nation's total are in New York and Pennsylvania and other eastern states, and they have ordered their drive-ins closed. The luckier operators are meanwhile proceeding with caution. Some require ticket takers to wear gloves and are introducing phone-only popcorn and snack orders, all delivered by staff to prevent concession stand crowds. But such precautions may not be enough in the longer run. In Austin, Texas, the Blue Starlight Drive-In, which was doing so well that its owner opened a second franchise, closed after the city adopted a shelter-in-place policy. And one operator in LaGrange, Kentucky, Stephen Sauerbeck, decided to delay opening his theater for the season after personally consulting with the state's governor. "It's a responsibility on our side to be as safe as possible," he said. "I don't want this to be, we found a loophole in the situation and we are going to operate an underground business here that the government is trying to shut down." Well, let's hope that the drive-in movie surge continues, because they were a lot of fun when we had them. I'm going to jump now over to another topic, which is completely different, if you don't mind. And even if you do, I think dogs' heat-seeking noses is an appropriate topic to follow drive-in movies. Just why, I don't know, really. But scientists may have solved one of the great mysteries of the animal kingdom. According to reports in Science magazine, reports as to why dogs have cold, wet noses. Most mammals have smooth, dry skin around the edges of their nostrils, an area known as the rhinarium. But dogs' rhinaria are moist, colder than the ambient temperature, and packed with nerves. Vampire bats have cool patches near their noses that act as heat detectors. So researchers in Sweden and Hungary wondered if canine renaria might work in a similar way, helping them to track warm-blooded prey. To test this theory, the scientists trained 3 pet dogs to identify which of 2 identical 4-inch wide objects had been warmed to about 22 degrees Fahrenheit above room temperature. All of the dogs were able to identify the hotter object at a distance of about 5 feet. Scientists then scanned the brains of 13 dogs as they were exposed to a warm object and one kept at room temperature. And sure enough, the part of the brain linked to the dog's noses became more active when the pooches were shown the warm object. It's a fascinating discovery, according to Mark Bikoff, an expert on canine sniffing. He's at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And he wasn't involved in the study, but it provides yet another window, he said, into the sensory worlds of dogs' highly evolved cold noses. USA Today reports that a record ozone hole over the Arctic is now gone. A record-breaking ozone hole that formed over the Arctic this spring has closed, according to researchers and scientists at the Copernicus Atmospheric Monitoring Service tracking the rather unusual ozone hole announced on Twitter that it had now ended. The group said the hole was caused by a polar vortex and closed when that vortex split. COVID-19 and the associated lockdowns probably had nothing to do with this, the group said repeatedly on Twitter. It's been driven by an unusually strong and long-lived polar vortex, and it isn't related to air quality changes. A polar vortex, you must remember, is a large area of cold, high air in the atmosphere that normally spins over the North Pole. An ozone hole is a dramatic thinning of the ozone layer. It's typically boosted in size by colder temperatures. Ozone holes have formed annually for the past 35 years in the Antarctic because of human-made chemicals that migrate into the stratosphere and accumulate inside a strong polar vortex. Because of unusually high temperatures high above the Antarctic, the ozone hole shrank to its smallest size on record last October. But in the Arctic, polar vortices are much weaker, meaning that the conditions needed for such strong ozone depletion aren't normally found, making this ozone hole unprecedented. Ozone depletion over the Arctic in 2020 was so severe that most of the ozone at an altitude of around 11 miles had been depleted. And researchers said that the last time a similarly strong chemical ozone depletion was observed over the Arctic was back in the spring of 2011. The ozone layer is important because it acts like a sunscreen. It blocks the potentially harmful ultraviolet energy from reaching our planet's surface. We come back to Earth now, and we have an article about Alexander Calder and how he upended the seriousness of art. His sculpture and mobiles played with space and with form, but some critics were not amused. The bright colors and biomorphic forms of Alexander Calder's sculpture and mobiles are instantly recognizable. Parks and plazas everywhere bloom with his public commissions, and his work is found in museums all over the world. He is easily one of the most influential artists of the 20th century, but for all of his visibility, Calder is not fully credited as a major artist. The mere fact of his popularity has turned off many art critics, with the exception of Jed Pearl, who has taken up the monumental task of producing a two-volume biography of Alexander Calder. The first was called Calder, The Conquest of Time, The Early Years, was published in 2017. And now we have the follow-up in 2020. The book is Calder, The Conquest of Space, The Later Years, has just been released. Having established Calder's background in the first volume, this book opens during World War II when Calder and his wife were living in Roxbury, Connecticut, where their home was a popular gathering place for many of the European modernists who had fled to America. This was natural because Calder and his wife had lived in Paris and were close friends with many of the refugees. Calder's very popularity worked against his artistic reputation. I want to make things that are fun to look at, that have no propaganda value whatsoever, Calder told one interviewer. He said, "There is no idea I want to express, no meaning. What I've tried to do is just create something interesting to look at. And in Perry's words, Calder was celebrating artistic escapism. Elation was a philosophical principle. And now, time for me to wind things up as we head out after another program of a little of this, a little of that. And I want you to be careful, take care of yourself, keep your mask on when you need to, keep that social distance, because it helps us all. And now it's time for me to go on the road and look for some more items to include in a little of this, a little of that, on the road again.